Hello and welcome to Spieling the Beans with me, Dom Stevens, the storytelling podcast in which storytellers tell stories about telling stories. My guest today is one of the UK's most recognisable and highest regarded journalists and broadcasters, perhaps best known for co-hosting the Today programme on BBC Radio 4 for 21 years. He's been an anchor of every BBC Radio UK elections results programme since 1997, he's worked on every US presidential election since 1988, and he's been a presenter of The Proms since 1992. He's been the chief political correspondent for both The Scotsman and The Guardian, as well as the Lawrence Stern Fellow for The Washington Post. And during his career, has won both the Scottish Press Awards Journalist of the Year and the Sony Radio Awards Radio Personality of the Year. He's a prolific author of both non-fiction books such as On the Road, American Adventures from Nixon to Trump, and The Accidental American, Tony Blair in the Presidency, as well as fictional novels such as The Spy Across the Water and Paris Spring. He's a Fellow of the Royal Society of Edinburgh. He succeeded Dame Diana Rigg as the Chancellor of the University of Stirling for a decade-long term, and he's been the chair of the Booker Prize. Recorded in the media yurt at the Edinburgh International Book Festival, we spoke about what makes a great interview, chance meeting JFK's speechwriter, disagreeing with Aaron Sorkin, the freedom of fiction, what makes a great novel, the ideal relationship between an editor and a writer, and so much more. So let's get straight into it. Please welcome my guest for this episode, James Naughtie. James, thank you so much for talking to me today.
It's a pleasure. It's lovely to be here in Edinburgh, although it's a trifle cold, but there we go.
It is, but we're in a very lovely yurt.
We are in a yurt, relaxing at the book festival.
Absolutely. I'd like to start with something that's perhaps a little meta, but you've interviewed so many world figures and cultural figures. What to you makes a great interview?
I think the essence of it, and it's true really whether you're dealing with a news interview in the course of a programme or a personality-focused interview on a longer basis, you know, for 15 or 20 minutes. In both cases, it's true that what you need to remember is that the answer is more important than the question. Mm-hmm. Now, what you're trying to do is get somebody to give you something. And sometimes that can be by means of a very simple question. Sometimes it can be by silence. It's seldom achieved by preaching in any way. Now, of course, in political interviews, which I used to do very frequently when I was presenting the Today programme regularly, of course, you sometimes get into an argy-bargy, and there is a confrontational element, and you have to give as good as you get, and there are politicians who love fast bowling. I mean, they like tough questions because they perform better against, you know, fast bowling than they do against a slow underarm, a full toss. So there is that kind of interview, but I think broadly, if you're trying to explore what someone thinks or get under the skin, it's about remembering that you just want to find the trigger that will get them to talk. Mm-hmm. And however you can do that, do it. And it varies with different people. I mean, we're talking on the day after Michael Parkinson's death, and Parky, of course, had a very particular style, the late night sofa. But what made him brilliant and what made people want to open up for him was that he had an utterly genuine curiosity about what they might say. That's the essence of it. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, it was honest.
Yeah.
I mean, he might be very skillful about the way he went about trying to get someone to open up, but effectively, it was honest curiosity. And that's the basis of any good interview.
Well, hopefully we can achieve that
well,
in this year.
I hope so. Yeah.
In around 2020, you spoke to Aaron Sorkin. and
he's hero of mine.
And same as mine. Same as mine. Well, we share a great love of American presidency and politics, and I devoured On the Road. And
you can tell the episodes of The West Wing when he stopped writing.
Season four, there's a drop off for sure. Well, he surprised you when he said, no, he couldn't write a drama about the Trump White House because, and I quote, there's no such thing as an interesting character who has no conscience. Do you agree?
I don't agree. That did surprise me. I can see what he meant in that dealing with Trump as a figure is very difficult because you're dealing with something so gargantuan, so uncontrollable, an ego that is so vast that it just fills the space and leaves nothing for something else. Mm-hmm. But come on, I don't believe that somebody like him, who's a brilliant writer for the screen, couldn't make something of it. I can see why he said it, because I think at that time he was so bored by what had been happening in the White House for 4 years, and I think probably revolted by it, mm-hmm. because of his own views, that he just thought, I just don't want anything to do with this. I would find it uncomfortable and difficult and not something I would want to embark upon. I think that's what he meant, because I think the statement itself is bollocks, really. It's not true. I mean, the interesting thing about Sorkin, when you look at the film about Steve Jobs mm-hmm. that he wrote. Now, I would walk a long way to avoid seeing a film about Steve Jobs, because I think in the end, a remarkable man, an extraordinary figure, an innovator, a powerful person in all our lives, one way or another. Mm. But I've always found him rather uninteresting, in the sense that I just don't want to spend time with this character. Sure. The minute you get Sorkin writing a script, you're away. Mm-hmm. And I think he's a brilliant writer. Mm. I'll tell you a secret. We share an alma mater.
Is that true?
I was at university, at Syracuse University, New York, for a year in 1974. And that is his alma mater, as indeed it is Joe Biden's. I'd have thought you knew that.
You have reminded me of that fact.
Right. We weren't there at the same time, needless to say.
Yeah, I was going to say, do the three of you meet up at the coffee regularly?
No, I think we're all different eras, put it like that.
Yes. Well, staying on the subject matter of presidential rhetoric, your chance meeting with Ted Sorensen in around 2008, I think when he was checking into the Brown Hotel.
You're very well briefed.
Yeah. Oh, thank you.
You've read the book.
I'm a big fan. Of course, legendary JFK speechwriter. We choose to go to the moon, inaugural address, and so on.
Yes.
And he was in town to address the 2008 convention, and he was excited about how he was able to help two, and I quote, extraordinary candidates for president, Obama and Kennedy.
That's right.
In terms of rhetoric, how do you compare the two? And also, what are your memories of meeting such a great literary figure as Ted?
Well, how do you compare them? I think the point about Kennedy, whom obviously I never heard speak, mm-hmm. I was a boy when he was president, just going into my teens. But obviously I remember the impact that he had, those press conferences, the debates with Nixon in the 1960 campaign. Mm-hmm. The reason that it was so startling, I think, was a combination of his youth and his relative eloquence,
yeah,
compared with Eisenhower. Now, Roosevelt had been eloquent during the war, but, you know, America simply wasn't used to someone who could do this with such panache. Mm-hmm. But Obama took it to a different level. I mean, Obama was somebody who spoke with, obviously he didn't come from the South, but, a Southern preacher's cadence, understanding of cadence, mm-hmm. Very much reared in the tradition of black church going. Mm-hmm. And, irresistible. I remember the speech he made accepting the nomination, which was outside at the Denver Broncos Stadium in Denver in that year, 2008. And they had decorated the stage with some Grecian columns. It looked absolutely appalling. And you could see that Obama was aware that this thing might fall flat because it might look extraordinarily hubristic. Mm-hmm. So he came on stage, 80,000, 90,000 people outside under the stars. Mm-hmm. And he began very slowly, very clever. And then he, worked it up, speech of about an hour. And I've never really heard anybody who could do it like that. Although Bill Clinton, people sometimes say, well, what was it about Bill Clinton? Well, I mean, there are two things. One, the physical presence. His photographic memory, so he could meet someone and say, well, I remember seeing you 6 years ago in a queue. We were having a cup of coffee in New Hampshire or something.
Sure.
And he could do it. I mean, it came from some data bank in his head. The other thing about him was that when he was in full flow as a speaker at his peak, mm-hmm. he was absolutely brilliant. So I think comparing Kennedy and Obama is sort of fruitless, because I think if you look back at Kennedy, it all seems a bit tame now.
Yeah.
I mean, the great speeches, in Berlin or at the inaugural, were terrific. And I mean, I know a couple of people who were at the Berlin speech, which was a very small crowd. It was outside. They couldn't hear very well. But we all go back to, ich bin ein Berliner, I am a hamburger.
Sure.
I don't think he had what Obama had, but of course he had extraordinary presence. The wonderful thing that Sorensen said to me after I met him by chance, I just recognised him. And even then he was losing his sight. It was quite a difficult physical encounter in that sense. Mm-hmm. But he was very gracious and charming and rather flattered to be recognised. And we sat and talked about it, and he said that both Kennedy and Obama had a quality in common where they were able to, in a crowd, stand apart, seem apart, seem slightly beyond it and above it. Great gift for a political figure. I mean, of course you want to be glad-handing and so on, but you've also got to be able to project the notion that you are slightly different.
Yes.
That you've got a different quality. And that's what he thought they both had. And he died not long after. I think he died about 3 or 4 years later.
Yes, 2010.
But 2010 it was, 2 years later. But he did admire Obama, and he saw Obama reflecting something. Of course, the other thing you have to remember about Sorensen and Kennedy is that they were very close. He cooperated on the book, Profiles in Courage, in the mid-50s. He worked for him. He was his wordsmith when he needed some help, although, you know, Kennedy himself could fashion a great phrase. But they were never blood brothers.
Mm-hmm.
The closeness for Kennedy was with his own brother, Bobby, not with Sorensen, who was very much not a member of the family,
mm-hmm.
but staff. And, of course, he remained close to the family, you know, for the rest of his life, but always as not quite a retainer, that's putting it too strongly, but as somebody who was employed and who was a loyalist rather than, you know, the blood brother. And I think that's important to remember.
Absolutely. I was indeed going to ask about the level of calmness that he saw between the two figures.
Calmness.
And how important you feel calmness is in leadership.
Oh, I think it's extraordinary. I mean, if you look at great moments and how people deal with critical challenges,
yeah,
in power, I think it is the sense of stillness, authority, control, what people look for, mm. whether it's, you know, a domestic crisis of the kind that, let's say, Mrs. Thatcher had to face several times, whether it's 9/11 or something on that scale. What people want, whatever words they use to formulate it, what they really want is a sign of someone in control. When Roosevelt spoke to the Americans the day after Pearl Harbor and talked about it being a day that will live in infamy, he spoke in words that were extremely powerful, but they weren't inflammatory.
Yeah.
They were reassuring. And I think at moments of crisis, reassurance, a sense of understanding, is what people want, whatever their political views are. That's where Obama was remarkable at times of national crisis, with a mass shooting, that kind of thing. Moments of tragedy was at his best. You know, I think a lot of people would have a very critical account of his foreign policy, especially with respect to Syria and so on, and maybe his inexperience in international affairs came through in that. But I think when you saw him responding to moments when leadership was required, it was very, very striking.
Mm. On the notion of power, which you mentioned there, when you write about the Watergate hearings and Nixon's fall from grace, to put it mildly, you note, for anyone with even the faintest interest in the psychology of power, this was a performance to be savoured from start to finish. What interests you in the psychology of power?
I think what intrigues me always is the extent to which you balance ego, ambition, all these things,
yeah,
which are needed if you're going to go for power. If you're going to go for power, it's not going to fall into your lap. You've got to want it. You've got to taste it. You've got to be willing to fight for it. Otherwise, unless you're a very, very rare figure indeed who has a stroke of luck, you're not going to get there. The trick then is to make sure that you don't let that ego, those, if you like, selfish instincts take over. And you understand that when you're exercising power, you're talking to people beyond yourself. And it's that balance that people, inevitably, because we're all human beings, struggle to get right. And I think that's where it's fascinating. When people start to lose it, when they get that balance wrong. You know, I've talked, as it happens, doing some programs in the last few weeks with people who served in the Thatcher government. Mm-hmm. It's obviously one of the most extraordinary periods in our post-war history, just for the sense of change, of direction, of rigour at the heart of government. And they all say, whether they were devoted to her from the beginning or whether they were reluctant admirers or whether they were pretty persistent critics, that after about 8 years, she'd lost it.
Yeah.
She'd lost the grip. Now, that's what's always interesting when that moment comes. And can you see it? Do you know when the moment is when you get out? And, you know, the older I've got, the more I've realised is that I think everyone has a shelf life, you know.
Yeah.
And it's not as long as they think.
Yeah.
And keeping that self-awareness, you know, it's very difficult. I remember Blair, after Iraq, the invasion of Iraq in 2003, when he became a heroic figure in the US, because one of the things he'd been able to do after 9/11, mm-hmm. 2 years before, was to choose exactly the right words. He somehow got it. Mm. And that was instinctive on his part. I mean, nobody told him what to say. He just knew. Jacques Chirac, then president of France, was actually in Washington when it happened. It made no impact at all. I mean, just couldn't find the way to do it. Blair just understood it. Anyway, for one reason or another, he became a hero. And he addressed both houses of Congress, a rare honour for a foreign leader, in the summer of 2003, in July, Washington. And he got, I think it was 17 standing ovations or something. Now, you know, a lot of that goes with that kind of occasion. But nonetheless, if that happens to you, very, very difficult for it not to go to your head.
Sure.
Very difficult.
Yeah.
How many of us?
Exactly.
I think myself that one of the mistakes, looking back, that Blair made was he didn't realise that he was powerful enough to have stepped back if he'd wanted to before the invasion. Bush offered them the chance in February. And he didn't take it. Now, Blair would say he did it as a matter of purpose because he had committed himself and he wasn't going to go back on his word. That may be true. But I think he maybe even then underestimated the influence he had. Mm. I think it would have made a bit of a difference in the States.
Well, you close chapter two of On the Road, and we'll move on to the Spy Across the Water after
right.
this.
That's good.
I just wanted to quote it one more time. You close chapter two of On the Road with the hypotheticals that struck you as a 23-year-old watching the Nixonian falling.
Yes.
And the final hypothetical is you ponder what drives people when they know they are headed for defeat. And I was wondering, you perhaps essentially answered it there, if you've had, in the decades, knowing
well,
politicians.
Well, it's sense. Very interesting, isn't it? You see, I think if you look at Trump,
yeah,
what is clear psychologically about Trump, and I'm talking as a journalistic observer, not as a psychiatrist or as a psychologist.
Sure.
But I don't think you need professional expertise to look at him and conclude from the way he's behaved, really throughout, but particularly since his defeat in 2020, mm-hmm. that he is almost psychologically incapable of accepting defeat, of mm-hmm. believing that it can have happened.
Yeah.
And I think if you listen to the whole of that phone call to the Georgia Secretary of State, which As I speak to you, Dom, I confess I haven't. But I've heard large chunks of it.
Sure.
My wife was saying to me the other night that she went back, because we've just heard the Georgia indictments and so on, and listened to it, because you can hear it, you know, live, mm-hmm. and listened to the whole thing for an hour, and said, the minute you hear it all, with all the sort of mafia speak, you know, we wouldn't want anything to happen to you kind of thing.
Yeah.
What you also realize is that by that stage, he had convinced himself
yeah.
that he'd won.
Yeah.
It was rubbish, of course. There was no evidence for it. The evidence all pointed the other way, and it's irrefutable. But his concept of specialness is so profound, and the egocentricity, if you like, is so profound, that he couldn't accept that it was possibly being defeated. Now, that's very, very unusual. Most people know.
Mm-hmm.
But goodness me, it must be tough.
Yeah.
It must be tough. I mean, I've known ministers, cabinet ministers, who have had, I mean, without getting into medical terminology, who virtually had breakdowns
sure.
after being sacked, because the sense of failure, of shame, of disappointment, having climbed up this greasy pole for so long
yeah.
to get there, and then find yourself in half an hour
yeah.
slipping down again to the bottom, can be a devastating experience.
And the sense of identity wrapped up in job title.
The sense of identity and the public
sure.
Awareness that everything is on show. Everyone knows that you've screwed it up or you've been kicked out or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And the pressure to make sure that every word you then use about it is correct, because they'll always be remembered.
Mm. Well, turning to Spy Across the Water.
Just like that.
You noted in the launch of it, in, I believe, a branch of Waterstones in the spring of this year, you said something which stood out to me, which was that whilst the mise-en-scene of Washington in the 80s is accurate, Mr. Smith's bar, Nathan's on the corner of M and Wisconsin,
yeah.
everything else is fictitious, and you made the, and you define it as a tricky decision, not to talk to people who were intimately aware with certain
things. That's right. I mean, what I thought, as somebody who, you know, applied a trade as a working journalist for a long time, mm-hmm. first in newspapers and then in broadcasting, and the difficulty for me in trying to write fiction, kind of in the spy genre, if you like,
yeah.
Was being sucked into a commentary on events, which would be my instinctive way of operating. You know, why did somebody do that one? And what I wanted to do was write a book about people and their minds and how they would behave under certain circumstances when they were placed under pressure in various ways. And therefore, I didn't want to paint in the background, this is 1985, mm-hmm. to say, you know, Mrs. Thatcher was Prime Minister, President Reagan was there, they were discussing things with Gorbachev and so on. It's all there,
mm-hmm.
but I don't want to get into it. And I certainly didn't want to ring up people whom I knew, which I could have done,
mm-hmm.
and said, well, the negotiations on the Anglo-Irish Agreement, which play a very important part in the story,
mm-hmm.
which concluded in 1985, how were they going at that time? Now, I remember it. I covered it, and I knew people who were involved. And I know people on both sides of that argument. It was very fraught between London and Dublin at the time. I personally think it's one of the best things that Mrs. Thatcher ever did, but that's, by the way, that doesn't matter. That was a really much more profound step than was widely understood at the time, and I think she understood it. But I didn't want to get into day-by-day details of what happened,
yeah.
because I would have been drawn into the politics. I would have written about the politics and not the people.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's full of things that are true. The sense that the Americans were beginning to get interested for the first time in gun running for the IRA from the States is absolutely true. And I know that because I spent some time there in the early 80s and was aware of that. So there's a lot of the background which is accurate, it's authentic.
Mm-hmm.
But no, I didn't want to get into the intricacies of the politics. It'd be boring. I mean, read a history book, don't read a novel.
Sure. You've spoken before about how you relish the idea of writing fiction as opposed to non-fiction. How would you categorise that sort of sense of relief? What about it
freedom.
Really sort of... Freedom.
Freedom, I think. It's a freedom with limits, because if you screw it up and it's not readable, Yeah. And it doesn't sort of make sense, and it doesn't flow, and frankly, people don't want to turn the page. Well, what's the use of freedom if you've misused it so that you know it doesn't mean anything? Mm-hmm. So to that extent, it has its own disciplines, but making it up in story terms is something that you know we don't do in the BBC for obvious reasons. Mm-hmm. And so it was just exhilarating.
Sure.
And you see, the way I do it is, I know the beginning and I sort of know the end. I kind of knew where I wanted to land the plane mm-hmm. after 300 pages, pretty accurately. But what came in between, I didn't really know at all. I mean, I had all kinds of things floating around, ideas and little scenes and places I might want to go and people. But they were all in a jumble, you know. And then people start to emerge, and you think, well, you're interesting. Or, now there's an idea, let's follow that through. And gradually, you start to work. I suppose it's like painting on a blank canvas. You start to fill it in, and you get interested in one little corner. And then you say, well, look, why do we have a bit of sky there. Let's go on an expedition into some dark corner. And that I just find exhilarating yeah. because you switch off from day-to-day events and you're talking about people that only exist in your imagination. I mean, there's one, as you well know, there is one real person in this story, James Jesus Angleton, famous CIA figure, mm-hmm. who's driven mad by his betrayal at the hands of Kim Philby. And he is there, safely dead in 1987, so I didn't have to worry about that. I mean, everything has been said about Angleton, so whatever you say, nobody's going to object. And it was just quite nice to have him there as a sort of ghostly figure from the past that Fleming, my hero, so to speak, who's ambassador in Washington, mm-hmm. would have known, of course, by reputation. And he runs into him, and it's part of the story. So that's almost a nice little kind of walk-on part for a real figure. But nobody else in the political firmament, or indeed among the spies or the civil servants, is remotely real.
Mm-hmm. And I can totally understand the freedom that would provide you with, and the ability to sort of have
If you tie yourself to events, you end up having to be accurate. I mean, you then become driven by events.
And constrained.
And the minute you're driven and constrained by events, then you can't write a full story. I mean, you're writing a sort of simulacrum of the truth, which I didn't want to do. I want to write fiction.
Yeah, it's like sort of cartography. You have to map it to
right.
to what happened.
That's right.
You've spoken with a great friendship and admiration towards your editor at House of Zeus, Rosie.
Rosie de Courcy, yes, she's wonderful.
What does a good editor do? As an author, what do you find beneficial, and did you ever disagree over the project?
Oh, yeah, we disagree on things, but I think what a good editor, and Rosie's as good as you'll get, especially in non-fiction, mm-hmm. is that obviously she or he has to warn you if you're getting carried away with something that just isn't working. You know, that you're going off on a kind of wild goose chase in the story, or and there's that sort of steady on, come on, just put this away for 3 days and then look at it again. Do you really want the chapter to start like that? There is that, of course.
Yeah.
But the most fundamental thing, I think, is getting into your head and realizing how you will do the job best. What it takes to encourage you to develop your own instincts, not to try to place something on you, not to put a template on your desk and say, follow that and you'll write a good story. To understand what you want to do and to help you get there.
Yeah.
And in order to do that, I think you've got to have a very sharp understanding of the individual, the writer. You've got to know what it is that drives them, you know, why they can, and what tricks they can pull off and what tricks they'll never be able to pull off. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, that's true of everybody. But she, and you know, Rosie's history is extraordinary. I mean, she edited Len Dayton. she edited Winston Graham's Poldark novels. I mean, you know, there's just, you know, the breadth of her experience. Uh-huh. And she's interested in the subject matter. And we get on terribly well. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing like a boozy lunch with an editor to sort of, you know.
Sure.
Just, oh, don't do that. That character really doesn't work. Why don't you just get rid of him? Mm-hmm. And then a sense of relief when you say, yeah, that feels better.
Yeah.
So it's all that. But it's honesty, to be honest with you, Don. I mean, that's what it is. It's straightforward honesty. What an editor should never do. They can be psychologically clever in the way they persuade you maybe to do something that you don't want to do. But they should never trick you.
Yeah.
It's got to be straight, even if it's critical. And it has to be critical sometimes. I mean, if you just sit there and, you know, all people who write are bound to be, to some degree, interested in the performance, because that's what it is. And if you just sit there and butter them up and flatter them, I mean, that's hopeless. Mm-hmm. You know, you've got to be quite tough. The football manager.
Sure. The hairdryer effect.
The hairdryer.
Is it similar to the relationship with an editor and a journalist?
Yeah, I think so. I think a good editor is really tough. And a good editor knows what he or she wants. And there's no point as an editor, if you're editing a newspaper,
yeah,
there's no point in trying to be nice to everybody. That's hopeless. They've got to know what you believe the paper should look like, should feel like, should how it should breathe. Mm. If you don't like it, go and work somewhere else. And then what the editor has to do is to encourage people to give of their best. Mm-hmm. It's exactly like took the analogy of the football manager a minute ago. It's exactly like that. It's getting people in the right positions and then giving them the freedom to play as they want and then building them into a team. And an editor's job, it seems to me, and it's true of radio and television programs as well, is that you try to fill every position in the team and make sure that the right people are in the right places so that their talents are exploited and that the whole thing, you know, rises like a souffle. It's an appalling mixture of metaphors, but that it all comes together in the end.
Yeah.
And it's really quite difficult, and it involves disappointing people quite often and mm-hmm. saying no and chucking stuff out. And I think any decent editor is going to have tussles, even with his or her favourite writers or broadcasters, because if they're not tough, the respect is not there.
I fully agree. Speaking as an author and the former chair of the Man Booker Prize, what makes a great novel?
Well, to state the obvious, they come in different shapes and sizes. Mm-hmm. But a great novel has to create a world of its own, which is complete, mm-hmm. which has a shape, a character, a solidity, and an authority, a kind of integrity of its own that takes the reader there. And it doesn't matter whether it's a comic novel, great, you know, Hilary Mantel historical novel, a Le Carré spy novel, whatever it is, that's the rule. You have to feel when you open the page and step inside that you're in somewhere that you can understand, you can study, and you can react to. You know, people talk about Graham Greenland.
Sure.
When you step into the pages of a Graham Greene novel, you know exactly where you are. Mm-hmm. You know the people that are there. You want to be taken on the journey that he's going to take you page after page. And I think that's true at all levels, not just a level of brilliance that a writer like Greene could just summon up. But even people writing, you know, at a much more workaday level, A good novel creates a world that takes you out of yourself.
Mm.
And if a novel can't do that, it doesn't really work.
Mm.
That's my view.
And it's one I share. As the wild world of the Edinburgh Book Festival attests, the current Icelandic Prime Minister was here yesterday talking about her in the free time she writes crime novels.
Yes.
And I got the chance to speak to her, and I asked her, as a world leader and an author, is there another author you feel like would make a great world leader? And I'd like to pose that question to you too.
What a good question.
Thank you.
An author who would make a great... I can think of many authors who wouldn't. That's a much easier question. An author who might... Gosh. You know, it's... It seems to me that the qualities that you need to be an imaginative writer, creator of art,
yeah,
and the qualities that you need to be disciplined in the public sphere, to operate in the public interest with all the drive and all the stuff you need in order to carry that through, are so different. I mean, I'm sure there are people lurking around who bizarrely might do quite well if they were in public life. I can't think of many offhand. I would prefer they continue to do what they do.
Sure.
I mean, I think a poet should be a poet. You know, I thought Seamus Heaney was one of the greatest, not just a great poet, but a great humanitarian, a man with an enormous reservoir of feeling for things that mattered and of understanding the tragedy of the island of Ireland, above all. But I don't know whether Seamus would have been any good as Taoiseach or as First Minister of Northern Ireland. I mean, I know he would have hated it.
Sure.
And I would much rather he was a poet.
Yeah.
Which he was, thank goodness.
Yeah.
So that's really my answer. And the truth is, you wouldn't know until it happened. And the problem is, once you've elected somebody, it's too late.
Yes. It's very easy to get buyer's remorse.
Yeah. That's right.
You speak of Robert Frost in On the Road, and you quote him as
saying, "I'm a great Frost fan."
The bonfire in particular, the best way to come is to come up the hill with me and have our fire and laugh and be afraid. And I love that phrase, the concept of laugh and be afraid. What brings you? There's a lot of things to be afraid of right now. What brings you comfort?
The next generation. I think that when people despair about economic decline, you know, which we've experienced in this country in the last decade or two, beyond question, or about the rise of authoritarianism, which should worry anybody who grows up in a reasonably free society, or, and this does worry me, the depth of division in the United States about its own democracy and its principles as a society. I think the solution for worrying about all these things, which can be very gloom-making, is the next generation is going to look at all this, we can only hope, and say we can do better than this.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's on the environment, where I think there's fantastic innovation and idealism. We're not talking about, you know, absolutist views of how you change the planet for the better, but practical views about just making the place livable for the foreseeable future. And I think politically, if you look at this country, I was talking to a retired politician the other day, talking about it, who said, you know, it's going to be the next generation that do it. You know, the people who are now in their early 30s, there's a kind of moment that we just know that this generation is pretty clapped out and we need some new thinking. And there is absolutely no reason to believe that it isn't there. You know, people talk about the BBC has been going through all sorts of problems and financial cuts and everything else. The kids, if I can use that, not at all disparagingly, who come on to programmes like the Today programme or World at One in their 20s, from student radio stations, from local radio, the various training schemes and so on, They are absolutely as bright, as committed, as disciplined as any of the previous generations we've done that, and probably more knowledgeable about more things simply because the equipment is there now. And it, you know, you can't meet these people and not be optimistic. It seems to me in this country, one of the things we're getting to grips with, I think, mm-hmm. I hope, is that one of the great British failures of the second half of the 20th century is to get our education system right. I don't mean simply in the public-private split. I mean, that's a subsidiary argument in a way. But the failure to excite more people in scientific and, you know, mathematical advance, and the failure to bed in technical education as something to be admired. Mm-hmm. And, somebody quoted the other day a German friend of his saying, the thing about your country is as long as you pay accountants more than engineers, you're stuffed. He put it actually slightly more crudely than that. I've got some sympathy with that view.
And as do I. I have just a couple of questions before I let you go from this hostage situation that it's turning into.
Perfect.
But I can't let you go without talking about today. And I rewatched your final words in the programme, and the emotion that filled your voice spoke to how important that role was. What did that role mean for you?
Well, radio is a very intimate medium. Words matter. Tone matters. And particularly if you have the privilege of sitting there first thing in the morning, when people are getting up or turning over in bed or doing nameless things or whatever they're doing, kicking the dog or taking the dog for a walk or getting ready for school, and you're intruding into their lives. Mm. And I think if you have no sensitivity to that, then you can't do the job. But if you do have sensitivity to it, of course, it reminds you what an intrusive thing it potentially is, and why it's important to be a friend rather than some kind of, you know, somebody coming in from outside to disturb your day. Mm-hmm. And that means, without wanting to sound too kind of glutinous about it, that you are aware of having had a privilege. And, you know, apart from the Elston, it's great fun.
Sure.
You know, I sat there in the presenter's chair for 21 years.
Yeah.
And I think, as I said in that last programme, just things happen in front of you. People come and go, events come and go, and you have a chance to see them. And what I always think, and I'm, you know, still working very hard in broadcasting as a special correspondent, but mm-hmm. what you've felt there and what I still feel when I'm at an event or at a happening or listening to a speech or interviewing somebody, what you're saying to the listener is, you're not there, I am. This is what it's like. It's what it feels like. This is what this person looks like. This is what this event means. This is how it is unfolded. And the privilege of doing that, of being the conduit, mm-hmm. is great. So, well, you know, and I'm an emotional old soul. So, you know, at the end of 21 years of doing that, and I was very excited about what I was about to do, but it was inevitable I'd get weepy. And then, of course, one of the producers, Adam Kamersky, had put together this tape at the end with Scottish fiddle music underneath. Sure. Well, I mean, he knew perfectly well what the effect of that would be. Old softy, you know. So it was, it was a very emotional day.
Yeah, that speaks to what you were saying before about an editor knowing you intimately and knowing what would affect you.
Well, I'll tell you, when you come into a place at 4 a.m, they get to know you pretty well.
Sure, I'm sure, in every state.
They do.
Penultimate question.
Yes.
Parts A and B. What is the best advice you've received? What's the worst advice you've received?
The best advice, I think, I could give anybody in my trade, mm-hmm. which is the only thing I'm competent to talk about,
sure.
is, frankly, and this might sound an unlikely thing, keep it simple. You know, tell the story. If it's a good story, it'll have its own power. And I think that is the thing you have to keep in mind, along with what I said earlier about interviews. Never, ever forget that the answers are more important than the questions. The worst piece of advice, what's the worst piece of advice I've ever had? I mean, I've had quite a few along the way, you know, one-off pieces of advice that I haven't much appreciated. The very worst piece of advice I ever got was from the careers advice people at university, who said to me that I should become a health service administrator. This after I'd said I wanted to be a journalist, and they just laughed and said, well, everybody says that, but none of them actually do. And if I'd taken that advice, I'm afraid the NHS would be even in a worse state than it is now. So that stands out for me.
I'm glad you didn't take that advice.
Me too.
And became a journalist and, of course, assistant salad chef, let's not forget.
Ah!
The
you
greatest
really have
level.
Read this book, yes, very briefly, in the Catskill Mountains.
Exactly, the Borscht Belt. My very final question, James.
Yes.
Why do we need stories?
We're people who tell stories to each other, to ourselves. It's the only way we make sense of the world and make sense of ourselves. It's as instinctive as breathing. Some people have the ability to write them down. Some people don't write them down, but they still tell stories. It's what language is for. And it makes us who we are because it stretches our imaginations. And without our imaginations, we're nothing. We are instinctive, natural storytellers. It's what keeps us alive.
James Naughtie, thank you so much for joining me today.
It's my pleasure.
That was great.
Thank you so much.
Well, I really enjoyed it hugely.
Oh, thank you.